My name is Sean, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the end of the facts. All the rest of this stuff is my opinion, and I'm not a spokesman for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an expert on alcoholism. I'm really glad to be here. I mean, wow, you got some speakers here. I mean, holy cow. I'm really honored to share this podium with men and women that I've known and respected for years. It's just, this is really wonderful to get to hang out with these people and listen to them. One of the reasons I love coming to these things is I get to hear them talk. Now it's my turn. Oh, well. Every conference has to have a low point. You know. I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. It's just terrific. I've had a good time. My sobriety date is April 24th, 1974, and that's amazing. I'm not the kind of guy that makes it in this program. I'm too cute and I'm too bright and I got too much going for me, and I know I got this little drinking problem, but let's keep it light. I'm the kind that's the secretary of a meeting by the time I'm 6 months sober, and by the time I'm 9 months sober, somebody says, "Where's Sean?" And somebody says, "Gee, I don't know. I haven't seen him in weeks." I mean, that's the kind of guy I am. I'm a great starter. I don't do anything for a long period of time. And the fact that I'm almost 25 years sober absolutely amazes me. It absolutely amazes me because I don't know what I did. Believe me, if I'd known I was going to be sober this long, I'd have been a better example. You know, I really would have worked at it. But you're stuck with what you got. Oh, boy. I wish I had a clue what I was going to talk about. There were four of us guys when I was 14 years old in Victoria, British Columbia. We all went to this Catholic boys' school called St. Louis College, and we used to have these dances with the St. Anne's Academy girls, which was a Catholic girls' school in Victoria, British Columbia. And we used to stand outside the dances when I was 14 years old, me and Danny O'Brien and Ivars Lucis and Lou Fletcher. And we had our suits on, and we'd pass around a little bottle, and we'd talk. I never knew what those three guys were doing out there. I needed to be there because I needed to drink them a bit to have enough courage to go in and dance with those St. Anne's Academy girls. But they were great guys, Danny and Ivars and Lou. Danny was a big Irish guy. He was taller than I was, and he had shoulders that were like this wide. And Danny had a separation in his front teeth, and he could talk with a toothpick sticking out of it, and I thought that was so cool. He was really smart, and he was really bright, and he was a brilliant artist, and he was incredible with the language, and he had plans. He was going to get a football scholarship to an American university, and he was going to be something. And Ivars was this little guy from Latvia, and Ivars, man, those St. Anne's Academy girls liked that girl, that guy. Man, he was this little compact guy. He had a body like one of those gymnasts, you know. He had shoulders like that and hips like that, and I had shoulders like that and hips like that, and his ass looked like two softballs in a bag. I mean, those St. Anne's Academy girls couldn't keep their hands off it. And Ivars could roll a cigarette from one side of his mouth to the other while he was talking. He also could raise one eyebrow. I have never been able to raise one eyebrow. I used to stand in front of the mirror and go like this and try to do it, you know. That was so cool to be able to do that. Ivars could just do it like that. And Lou, Lou Fletcher. Lou Fletcher was tall and pencil thin, and he had blue-black hair and that white Irish skin and those bright blue eyes. He had perfect teeth, and he was a great dresser, and he could get those St. Anne's Academy girls to do anything. And I knew that was true because he told me. I, on the other hand, couldn't get those St. Anne's Academy girls to do anything. I mean, I was out of luck with them. Lou was going to have a car business, an expensive car business, Mercedes and that Cadillacs and that kind of stuff. Ivars was going to get a scholarship to an American university, too. And I didn't have any plans. I was this tall, fat guy with thick glasses and crooked teeth, and I was weird. I was weird, and I didn't know why I was weird. I just didn't fit anywhere. I just knew that. I was uncomfortable with who I was. Nothing worked for me, and I had no plans, and I'd sit around, and we'd pass that bottle back and forth, and they'd talk about who they were going to be, and I couldn't jump in because I didn't know. I didn't have any plans. I didn't have any talent. I didn't have anything going for me. But after a couple of hits on that thing, I started feeling better about myself. And eventually we would go into the dance, and they'd dance, and I'd watch. And then I'd usually go outside and throw up. It was really swell. But somewhere along the line in that first year, I learned how to drink. I learned how to keep it down, and I learned how to talk, and I learned a lot of stuff. And by the time I was 18 years old, I declared myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know that I'd done it. When I started getting drunk when I was 14, by the time I was 17, I started taking some prescription drugs that that were in medicine cabinets that I used to raid. And I was in trouble with the chemicals, but the idea of living without them was really frightening to me because they were working for me. See, alcohol and that stuff made me normal. Alcohol and drugs made it possible for me to live a life that I wanted to live. I could talk to you. I could be with you. I could belong. I had a sense of being okay. And I said the phrase that only an alcoholic says, and if you're new here and you don't know if you belong here or if you've ever heard anybody saying this phrase, they belong here. And I was 18 years old, and I said, I can control my drinking. Only alcoholics say that. Social drinkers never deal with that concept. Social drinkers, if they do something stupid whilst drinking, they stop drinking. I think that's really weird, but that's what they do. But I said, I can control my drinking. I didn't want to get as drunk as I was getting. I didn't want to get as sick as I was getting when I did it. So I started on the great obsession of every abnormal drinker that I followed into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was to control and enjoy my drinking. Now, I don't know about you, but I never, ever got control and enjoy in the same room at the same time, ever. You know? When I was controlling my drinking, I was miserable. If somebody suggests to me that I drink two drinks a night, my first response is, how big are the glasses? And the only way I've enjoyed my drinking is wildly out of control. I mean, I want you to know that the reason I'm standing here is that I love to drink. I love getting shit-faced. Let's get that out of the way. I just love getting wrecked, bombed, blasted, ripped. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I not only love the effect, I love the festival. I love the ice cubes and the glasses and the you know, the umbrellas and, you know, toothpicks with garbage on them. I just loved it. Just loved it. I loved those intense intellectual conversations we got into while we're, you know, reappointing the Supreme Court. I loved those intimate relationships that sometimes lasted all night. I loved getting punched out. I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. The only way I've ever drank anything is wildly out of control. I am not a sipper. I am not a savorer. I am not a, I mean, you know, we were talking at dinner. I mean, I was the first one at the table to finish my food. I mean, I, you know, you eat, you sit down, it goes, whoo, that's it, you know. You drink, blast it back, and, you know, I love the burning all the way down and the explosion at the bottom and the burning all the way up. I mean, I just loved it. You know? God. So that's how I drank. I was a dangerous drinker. I was dangerous not only for me, but I was dangerous for you. Because I haul you along with me. Hey, come on, let's go. You know, and I'd get you into as much trouble as I was in. I was a real dangerous guy to be around. But I was always trying to be okay. I mean, you know, Danny and Ivars were off in college, and Lou was doing his thing, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but somehow I decided I had a talent that the world couldn't live without, and by the time I was 21 years old, I was in New York appearing on Broadway. Now, I don't know how all that happened. It's a weird story, but it all happened. Suddenly, there I was. I mean, suddenly, you know, in a few years, I was in my mid-20s, I was living the kind of life that they write people in books are about. You know, I was roaring around in limousines and going to parties and doing all that stuff, and I mean, I was having a really good time. Really, really good time. And by the time I was in my mid-20s, I was drinking a quart of scotch a day, and I picked up a little non-habit forming marijuana habit. And I was working the docks. Not the kind where the ships come in. Doctors. I love doctors. as a profession, there's nobody that's more ignorant or arrogant than doctors, and they're just terrific to get drugs from. Because doctors can't say goodbye. It's wonderful. They can't get you out of their office unless they write something. So if you give them the right information, they'll write what you want. So I knew how to work these guys. It was fabulous. So I was into the wonderful world of chemistry. I got a confession to make. I am an impure alcoholic. I'm sorry. I'm one of the generation that messed up a perfectly respectable little disease. I know there's some of you old-timers that'd be scary, but that's the way it was. I think if you'd probably had the opportunities and the availability we had, you'd have probably done the same thing, too. So anyway, I decided I needed to make some life changes because I was going insane. I was doing bizarre things, dangerous things. I mean, as you continue to anesthetize yourself, the body or the soul starts giving out signals that it's dying. And so what I was doing was constantly kind of doing dangerous, stupid things to kind of shock myself into being back alive. I don't know if any of you did that kind of stuff, but I did a lot of weird stuff out there. I'm the kind of drunk that you find beaten to death in an alley because I got a smart mouth. And I do stupid things. I mean, to give you an example, I lived in Manhattan, and I'd go to parties on the east side of Manhattan, and I lived on the west side, and it just was such a drag to just kind of go around Central Park. So I used to walk through Central Park at 3 o'clock in the morning, dead drunk in a suit. I mean, you know, you don't live through that kind of stuff, you know. And here I am, you know. I don't know why. This is a disease of inches and seconds, and there are people who are inches away from me and seconds behind me who are dead. I didn't look at any of that kind of stuff. I lived a totally unexamined life. You know, you come to and you've done it again. You don't look at it. You keep moving. That was my philosophy of life. A moving target is harder to hit. You know? I didn't want to know how I kept slamming into the same brick wall. I just knew I had to do something about myself because I was terrified all the time. And I was living a life that people envied. And there was something terribly, terribly different between what was going on inside me and what was going on outside me. I was building a house and destroying the foundations at the same time. I don't know if any of you identify with that, but that's what my life was like. So I started making moves to get better. I started doing the things to avoid coming here. You know, I started going to the psychiatrists and the psychologists and the gurus and, you know, the health things and diets and macrobiotic and, you know, different natural wines. I love natural wine. Different prescriptions, different combinations of stuff. And what I decided ultimately was that I needed a good woman, and I found her in an elevator. We were going to do a show, a musical, and she was a little dancer. She was the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. Little blonde with dimples, she's still the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. Her name is Bonnie, and some of you know her. We're still together. She's down in Arkansas at an Al-Anon convention. She's down there with about 200 people who are not discussing us. Man. Really annoys me. I mean, I'm her ticket to serenity, for God's sake. Yeah. We've heard a couple of Al-Anons. I want you to know, I love Al-Anon. I absolutely love Al-Anon. I love Al-Anon so much that I don't go to Al-Anon meetings. I think Al-Anons deserve a safe place from a guy like me, you know. I am trouble. I am trouble, man. But I love Al-Anon. Bonnie's been active in Al-Anon the entire time that I've been sober, and she's a very active member of the fellowship. She's just great. We occasionally have those Al-Anon parties at our house, which is like 20 Al-Anons get together and split a bottle of wine. And at the end of the party, they argue about who's going to take what's left home. No, I can't. I have a drunk at home. No, I'll take it. No. Finally, one of them says, oh, for God's sake, I'll take it. And then the other 19 think, I wonder if she's in the right program. They're the best. We got to talk at a conference in Cancun last February, about this time last year, and it was wonderful. It was a summer vacation thing, and there were 700 of us that took over this Club Med in Cancun. It was 8 days. If you ever get a chance and you got the bread, go. I mean, it's wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful, and we were there, and about six of the Al-Anons, there was nothing to drink at this whole thing. So six of them got the devil in, and they decided they were going to go have a drink at one of the other hotels. So six of them went. And after they came back, I said, how was it? Well, it took them half an hour to get to this hotel. Can you imagine six Al-Anons and a Mexican cab driver? And they got there, and they ordered a margarita and had two sips and walked home. That took them another half hour. An hour! Two sips of a margarita. I said, what are you doing? Just knock off! I mean, they just annoy me. They're the best. Anyway, I found her. And our, you know, we did that eye lock, you know, that eye lock, that terrible moment when an Al-Anon recognizes potential. You know? And I mean, once the lasers are turned on you, you're dead meat. You haven't got a chance. I mean, it's over, you know? She decided I was perfect with a little work. And she looked like she could probably take care of me, and so we started our dance of death. We ended up tangoing into AA and Al-Anon eventually, but man, we did the thing, you know? And we moved to California, and we got married, and she settled down. And one day we were having cocktails, and she took a sip of hers and said, this is boring, and put it on the coffee table and never drank again. And then she noticed that I drank. See, I drunks don't marry teetotalers. I didn't know anybody who didn't drink. I married a girl who was a 10 martini what the hell girl. I mean, we had a ball. And then she just stopped drinking. I mean, she didn't go with withdrawals, nothing. She was just over, done, enough of this, and that was it. And then she started looking at me, and oh, man. You know. And people who didn't know that I was a drunk thought that I was crazy, because I was totally unpredictable, and it was just wildly out of control. I was at that point where I had stopped bragging about my drinking. I was not lying about it, and it was medicinal. I mean, I needed to drink every day or I would go crazy. I knew that was true, and that's just the way it was, and I was trying not to get too drunk. You know, I was trying to get that kind of level where basically what I wanted to do was not feel anything, because there was a lot of stuff that was wrong with my life and with me, and I knew that if that stuff ever kind of crashed in on me, it would crush me, and I was terrified, and I was running fast, and it was crazy. And on April 23rd, 1974, I was arrested, dead drunk. I was taken down and photographed and fingerprinted and released on my own recognizance with the front of my pants from the waistband and the knees soaked in my own urine. And it got my attention. And I went home, and God was working, you know, because she wasn't there. She was off in Orange County saving somebody who didn't need to be saved, and she wasn't there. So we couldn't work it out, you know. We couldn't convince ourselves that it was their fault. She couldn't turn it around for me. And so I had a look at it. And for the first time in my life, at about 11 o'clock on April 23rd, 1974, I put together my behavior with my drinking. For the first time, I saw the connection, and until that moment, I wasn't an alcoholic. It didn't matter how many people had suggested that I drank too much. It didn't matter how many people said that I was absolutely out of control with my drinking. This is a self-diagnosed disease, and until the alcoholic himself understands it, he ain't got it. And until that moment, I wasn't an alcoholic. From that moment on, I was. And I had to do something about it. The next day I came to, and I went to work. I always went to work. Perhaps if I had not gone to work, I'd have gotten here sooner. But I went to work, and I didn't drink before 5 o'clock in the afternoon. One of the things that really annoys me is that you people drank in the morning. I died all day to avoid coming here, because I knew if you drank at noon, man, you were a drunk. I always poured mine into a glass. My father was a drunk who had bottles wrapped in brown paper bags. I knew if you drank like that, you were a drunk. So I poured my rot gut into glasses. We do what we can to avoid coming here. You know, I was not shooting for AA. I And I took aside, on April 24th, 1974, in the morning, I took aside a woman I'd been working with. She had 6 years of sobriety, and I'd been watching her for a year. Her name was Suzanne L. And I'm deeply grateful to her because Suzanne was attraction. Suzanne had 6 years. She has having a hell of a good time. She had good days and bad days, but she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She made no bones about anybody knowing that. And she was successful and happy and, you know, she just had the stuff. And I took her aside and I said the last phrase. I said, I'm an alcoholic and I got 20 minutes before I go to pieces. And she heard the screaming. And she dropped everything and she 12-stepped me. She told me her story. She read to me from the big book. She stayed with me all day and she took me to my first meeting. She also set up my sponsor to meet me there and did the thing and then she let me go. And the first meeting I walked into was absolutely, oh, man, it was terrifying. I mean, I just, oh, God. Oh. It was in Southern California in Hollywood, and they have large meetings. There was about 400 people there, and it must have been a real slow night for newcomers because it was like being dropped into a shark tank. I never seen so many teeth coming at me in my life. Hi, Lord. Yeah. Oh, man. And you touched me. Man, you were touching me. Oh. He got real close and said weird stuff like easy does it and keep coming back. And I didn't know what the hell you were talking about. I thought I was being really cool. I mean, I arrived in the $250 sports jacket from Saks Fifth Avenue, had on French gabardine slacks, Italian loafers, and a designer tie. I looked fabulous at my first AA meeting. I walked in and everybody knew that I was a drunk. There were a couple of things going on that I wasn't aware of. One of them was it was a rather warm night. I'd been drinking straight cheap vodka the night before. I had on a lot of lemon lime cologne and I smelled like a gimlet. And the other thing was that I had newcomer eyes. Now the only other place I've ever seen eyes like that, other than on a newcomer in AA, are on a dog loose on a freeway. I mean, I was white. There were whites all the way around. They were just terrified. I didn't know what you were going to... I thought, oh, God, we're going to wear funny hats. We're going to have secret handshakes. We're going to sing songs. It's going to be a nightmare. But I got to do it because I can't not drink. I can't not drink. I can't not drink. And I'm dying. You know? I'm dying. You put a light bulb in a sock and you hit it with a hammer. It still looks the same, but the light bulb shattered. That's who I was. That's who I was. And the thing happened that night. I didn't love it, but I felt safe. I felt understood and accepted. I got it very early in Alcoholics Anonymous that whatever I had to do to stay sober, there was one of you to talk to. See, all my life I'd gone to moral superiors. I'd gone to doctors and priests and psychiatrists and all those people, and some of them were really good, earnest people who were highly educated and really wanted to help us. And they had diplomas on their walls and all kinds of stuff, you know, and I would tell them my problem, and they'd say, this is what you should do about your problem. Somebody points a finger at me, I bite it off at the knuckle. There's something wrong with the way I learn stuff. But I came here, and you said, this is what I've done about my life. Take what you can use. And it was the truth. I mean, it may be more true for you than it was for me, but it was the truth, and I couldn't deny it. And I started listening to it, and the way you made it possible for me to listen is when I got up enough guts to tell you a little about myself, you said the miracle phrase, and as long as you keep saying it, we're going to be okay. And the phrase was, I know how you feel. None of those people with the diplomas had ever said that. They said, this is what you should do. You said, I know how you feel. As soon as you say that, it dampens down the anxiety enough that I can learn. And so I started learning. I started taking these 12 steps, this thing, you know. Admitted I was powerless over alcohol, it was clear that I could no longer predict my drinking. The idea of the first drink gets you drunk, I thought was a little hard. You know, I thought, all right, I'll buy it. But, you know, they didn't understand that the first drink was the one that settled me down. You know, at 5 o'clock, I would belt back the first drink. Well, maybe I'll have a drink.
Nah.
Well, yeah, well, no, nah. And then I'd have another drink, but the first drink was just the one that just kind of set it up, as far as I knew. But then I had to admit, I really had to admit that the first drink, after I had the first drink, I could no longer predict what was going to happen. I mean, I've always been amazed at those guys who stop off and have two beers after work. They're from Mars. I mean, I stop off and have two beers, and I come home in March. I mean, they'd actually have two beers, get in their cars, and go home. I mean, weird. So, I mean, it was over. You know, now I want to tell you, there's a lot of, I was kind of the first of the wave, of the big wave of the junk alcoholics, you know. And I had this discussion with Suzanne that first afternoon, and I had explained to her that I understood it was the drinking, but that I felt that what I should do is kind of touch down lightly into sobriety on a little pink cloud of Valium, you know, just kind of, you know, because I knew withdrawal would probably kill me, and so I felt that probably I should kind of detox medically on my own, you know, kind of. And thank God for Suzanne, because she looked at me in 1974. She had 6 years of sobriety, and she said, let me tell you what they told me when I came in. And that's 31 years ago. She said, we define sobriety as clean and sober in Southern California. I said, what does that mean exactly? And she said, that means we don't drink alcohol, and we don't take any self-administered mind-altering chemicals that affect us from the neck up. Got that? I said, right, ma'am. And I've been clean and sober ever since. Thank God. Now, there seem to be some people who have got a big problem that we're about to be taken over by addicts. Can you imagine taking over this mob? I mean, if you did, what would you have? Anyway, rest assured, nobody aspires to Alcoholics Anonymous. But we get a lot of them up in our area. You know, we got a lot of treatment and all that kind of stuff, and so we get a lot of addicts, and a lot of people get upset about it and nervous about it. And I don't. I mean, basically, if you're an addict, you know, come to open meetings, sit down, shut up and listen, and have a cup of coffee and hang out. And if nobody gets nervous about all that stuff, eventually what happens is they start hearing the language of the heart and the causes and conditions, and eventually they start to maybe, you know, get an idea that, well, awfully similar here, and get a little honest, and eventually they might describe themselves as addict alcoholics. Bingo! Get to read chapter 5. I mean, you just declared yourself in. You just said you're an alcoholic. Come on up here. You know, and they get a sponsor, they start going through the steps, and they get to that 4-step, and they start writing, and then they start sharing it with somebody, and they get honest about the fact that despite the fact that they're big badass junkies, they drank like pigs. Then they start calling themselves alcoholic addicts. That's fun. You know, nice. Then they go to the can and during a business meeting and get elected GSR. I'm to what? Start going to those area assembly brawls and all that kind of stuff and, you know, start getting in touch with the traditions, and eventually they become alcoholics. We just got to be a little patient with them. You know, it's fun. I love addicts. You know, I love talking to them, you know. You have to think metric when you talk to addicts, you know, because everything's in kilos and grams. It's tough, you know. And they're all dealers. I don't know who was buying. They were all selling. I don't know. But eventually what happens when I got them, I start talking to them. And, you know, what I tell them is this, you know, that the only resource for sobriety is in the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. The ones with sober experience, that's the only thing that counts here. It doesn't matter what your religious leanings are or your psychological theories. It's sober experience. How do you maintain a marriage sober? How do you get a job sober? How do you get fired sober? How do you become a member of a community sober? How do you live through the stuff like sicknesses and children's deaths and stuff like that sober? And the only place you find that is in the people who have been around here a long, long time, the ones who call themselves alcoholics. Now, if you're new here and you want to have a double, triple identification, that's swell. The only problem is that you're giving out a message that you're different from those old dudes. And you know what? They're going to accept that you're different than they are. And so they're going to start continue to share their sober experience with the people who are like them. And you're going to find yourself like I did at first, outside the circle again, because I started out doing that, calling myself an alcoholic addict. You know, just letting you know that my case was slightly different than yours, that I was a hyper-alcoholic. But in order for me to access the recovery, I dropped that. So if you're new and you're doing that kind of stuff, cut the crap and join the fellowship. And you old-timers, be very, very careful. You put yourself and your fellowship and your own personal program in great danger if you withhold your experience because you don't approve of the way we got here. It is very, very dangerous. You are desperately needed in this fellowship. Did you see this countdown? I was one of the older guys here. That's scary. That's scary stuff. If somebody comes to you with problems as far as what they've done or the things they've consumed that you don't understand, refer them to those of us who do. But don't throw them away. Don't turn them out. We're responsible for saving lives here. It's really important what we do here. It's really, really important. So I started doing this thing. I started taking this thing. My life was unmanageable. It was dribbling down my sleeve. And then I came to the second thing, which is came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I was going to meetings in Hollywood. I mean, there was some serious insanity there. I was a lightweight compared to some of those guys. You know, they were talking about eating their own eyeballs, for God's sake. You know, and I just threw up all over the place and did dumb things and sleazy things and tacky things and embarrassing things. And so I thought maybe I didn't fully qualify, that I'd just kind of cool it here. And I had been assigned a new best friend, and we were going to a meeting, and he was working on, he had thinning hair, and we were going to this really spiffy meeting in Beverly Hills. So he used to torture it forward and then move it all over to the side and spray it, you know. It looked like a hair helmet when he was finished, but it was, and it took a while he was doing it. And I was a little jumpy, I was a little quick when because I detoxed in these rooms. I'm one of those people who didn't have insurance. So I had to do it in these rooms. You know, I was one of the group that they gave a half a cup of coffee to, because I was just a little quick when I got here. I was a week sober, and I always wore a blazer, and I looked like I'd been here longer than I had. And they asked me to read chapter 5. When I was finished, the chair said it was the first time she'd ever heard it read in one breath. So anyway, he was fixing his hair, and he had a big medical dictionary, and I looked up a definition of insanity. It was a big, long definition, and out of the middle of it popped a phrase that enabled me to take the second step, and maybe it'll help you if you're having trouble. And the phrase was, quote, a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. Let me run that by you one more time. The definition of insanity, quote, a seeming inability to learn from one's mistakes. I told you I kept coming to in those circumstances all the time, and I never looked at how I got there. I just looked at how the hell I was going to get out of it. I lived an unexamined life. Years later, I looked up the definition of sanity, and a definition that stuck with me that I love is the ability to assess and anticipate the reaction to one's actions. I love that. I mean, my insanity was that if I hit you in the mouth, I was always surprised that you got angry. I thought that you would understand that I was upset. So my life was a mess. I mean, I was clearly crazy. I was making really irrational decisions, and I was starting to get into sobriety, and I was still making dumb decisions. And then they had the biggie, the big third step, came to, you know, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand God. Ho, ho, ho. You know, they slam you with that right on early. And I thought, oh, my God. You know, because I'd been raised an Irish Catholic as opposed to a Roman Catholic. And I, so I had a God that was a combination of Genghis Khan and Santa Claus. Basically, somebody who didn't like me very much but was occasionally willing to cut a deal. So my entire spiritual life was consisted of saying those two alcoholic prayers. The first one is, dear God, get me out of this and I will never do it again. And the second is, whew. And I got this little sponsor who said, you got to pray. And I said, what? And he said, you got to pray on your knees morning and night. And the prayer in the morning is, okay, God, let me know what you want me to do today and give me the stuff to do it with. And the prayer at night is, thank you, God, for keeping me sober. So I did it. I go to the bathroom, lock the door, get down on my knees and say, okay, God, keep me sober today and let me know what you want me to do. Then I get up and look around, unlock the bathroom door and walk out like I wasn't doing anything, you know? Then at night I go and lock the bathroom door, get down on my knees and thank you, God, for keeping me sober, get up, look around, unlock the door and act like I wasn't doing anything. I locked the door when I prayed. I left it open when I puked. But I started on the journey that we all got to go on. If you're new, I got some bad news for you. There's no spiritual side to this program. The whole damn thing's spiritual. These are based on spiritual principles that have been around since first century Christianity. They're also principles that appear in all the major religions of the world, in all the major philosophies of the world. They're simply a blueprint for living that makes sense to rational human beings. That's why they're so strange to us. But all of us, if we're going to stay here for any length of time, if we don't want to be the Halley's Comet of Alcoholics Anonymous coming in and going out and coming in, if we actually want to have a sober life that's worth living and not a life of missing drinking, then we've got to take the spiritual steps that they talk about. And the third step is we make a decision to do that. And the journey that we are asked to take is an inward and an outward one. Everybody's got to come to some kind of understanding of a higher power for themselves. The wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is you get to design and build your own house. And that house has got to be a house that's filled with some kind of spirit, or we die behind it. And I mean, the name and the description of the higher power doesn't really matter. Religions of the world were based on some kind of intense contact with a spiritual reality that the person then went on to keep the knowledge alive. The only problem with a lot of that religion stuff is it gets bogged down in rules and practices and dogmas and addiction to power. And it's really kind of simple, basically. I mean, basically, once the truth is grasped, page 55 talks about it. It says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And that's where we've got to go. That's where I had to go. I had to go inward and outward at the same time. I had to go find that place within me, that potential for a higher state of being, that soul, that spirit, that consciousness, that human heart, that humanity. I had to go find it, and it's within. And it's a tiny flickering flame within us. Sometimes it's just smoking. And we got to build it and live it. And it doesn't matter whether you call it God, Allah, the Allah, Buddha, the laws of nature, cosmic consciousness, we don't care. I don't even think the cosmic consciousness cares. But the only way to nurture that little flame is we got to go outward too. We have to be of service. We have to carry some kind of message to the people around us. We have to care about them. We have to encourage them. We have to reassure them. We have to be of service. Because that's the fuel for the flame. That's the healing power of love. Without this inward journey, nothing means anything. The misery never goes away. And you and I know about misery. You and I know about despair. You and I know far too much about a whole lot of stuff. And I see people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are willing to settle for an acceptable amount of misery. But without that journey, we'll never know real happiness. We'll never know peace. And peace is possible. Peace is within our grasp. By making the decision, we set out on the journey. We set out on the adventure. And I don't know when the change will happen for you. I don't know when the change will happen for me. It's happened in pieces. It happens along the journey. There is no destination. There's just the journey. And so in the third step, we're standing at the trailhead. We're standing at the departure gate. We're standing at the station to make the journey. You know, and I made the decision, the third step. It didn't mean that I had a contact. It didn't mean that I had a relationship with a God. I had just made the decision to pursue it. It's like if I make a decision to buy a house. If I make a decision to buy a house, I don't walk into a house. What happens is I go buy a newspaper, and I look at the ads, and then I find a realtor, and then we go out and we look at houses, and I go to a bank and find out what my financial situation is. And eventually, after several weeks, we may find a house that we like, and we make an offer, and there's a counteroffer and another offer, and eventually we come to an agreement, and then we go to a bank, and we put it into an escrow, and that goes on for months. And months later, I walk into that house. Months after I'd made the decision. So I take the third step, which means I stand at the trailhead, and if I'm smart, I have a guide for this journey. Somebody called a sponsor. Somebody who knows the trail. And what that sponsor says to me is, all right, what kind of baggage are you hauling? What do we have to build up your strength in order to take this journey? And that's what the fourth step is. The fourth step is I take a look at myself for this journey. Who am I? What are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What am I carrying that I got to rid myself of? And then I tell the guide who I am as rigorously, honestly as I can. And the guide says, okay, in order to make this journey, these are the parts you got to strengthen. These are the parts you've got to let go. This is what you've got to reform yourself in order to do this journey. And he says, here's some of the stuff you've got to work on, and those are the six and seven steps. The stuff I've got to let go of and the stuff I've got to build up. That's an ongoing process for me, the six and seven step, because this journey is not just a journey. It's an adventure. Let me tell you, if some guy gets up to this podium and says, I used to drink like a pig, and then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life is now a piece of cake, that's a fairy tale. My life is an adventure. And an adventure has really great parts in it, and really lousy parts in it. That's what makes it worth it. That's what makes the adventure exciting. And let me tell you, almost 25 years later, I'm still hooked on my own adrenaline. I love a good rush. I love a good rush. Surrender is an activity. I used to think surrender meant you would sit there and let God stick it to you. That ain't the way it is. Surrender is leaping into this thing. And I do it all the time. I love it. I love it. And before we really set off on the journey, the guide then says, okay, there's some business you got to take care of here before we set out. There's some people you got to fix some stuff with, so that you can make this journey unencumbered. And that's the eighth and ninth step. And so I did that stuff. I went to the people that I had hurt. The ones I had the most problem with were my wife and my parents and my close relatives, and I said, what do I do to make amends? And he said, in order to make amends to them completely, you got to be sober a long, long time. Because they've heard a lot of your promises. They've seen your old act. You got to show them a new one, and they're going to be watching it for years. I made all the financial amends. I sent out stuff in envelopes, $5 a month and all that stuff, doing all that stuff that they told me to do so that I could get to the journey, get to the adventure. And the adventure started at the 10th step. I set out on this thing. You know, my sponsor, when I first got sober, I said, listen, I think the most loving thing that I can do would be to divorce my wife. You know, there's been so much damage, and she's found Al-Anon, and I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're setting out on our journeys, and we can't repair it, and I think we should separate. And he said, you're not going to make any emotional decisions in your first year of sobriety. And I said, what the hell does that mean? And he said, that means you're not going to divorce your wife. You're not going to fall in love with anybody else. You're not going to move. You're not going to redecorate. You're not going to quit your job. You're not going to find another job. You're not going to quit smoking. You're not going to start jogging 20 miles a day. You're not going to lose 35 pounds. You're not going to start reading psychological books. You're going to put your entire life on hold. You're going to work the 12 steps, and you're going to get sober, and it takes about a year. And I said, but you don't understand. I'm not sure that I love her. He said, I don't give a damn about love. Work on good manners. I started saying please and thank you to my wife. We're still married. So around a year sober was when I had done enough of the kind of background work that I was ready to set out on the adventure. You know, the tenth step I look at my life every day, I look at what I've done today. I have a lot of trouble with right and wrong because, I'm Catholic, you know. If you think about it, you've done it. And if, you know, And if you've done it, you're going to hell. I mean, I didn't do no venial sin. I mean, I went straight to mortal, man. I go for the big ones, you know. And so right and wrong, whenever I do anything wrong, I beat myself up worse than anybody, any of you would. So I look at my day and I say, what did I do today that I approve of, and what do I do today that I didn't approve of? And the stuff I don't approve of, I set out to change. The stuff I approve of, I put aside, because I start thinking about all the stuff I approve of, then I probably really don't need to do all that work. I'm doing really, really well, you know. So that's what my 10th thing is. And then the 11th step is this continuation of this search for that thing inside me, that my humanity, my goodness, you know, character. You know, Tom talked about that. I love that, you know. Who you are when nobody's looking, you know. Trying to find out who I am when nobody's looking. And I do that meditation thing. The thing that I do now, I've tried a whole bunch of them, but the easiest thing for me is to concentrate on the phrase, be still and know that I am God. And what I do is I take that phrase and I break it down into the words. I find a comfortable chair to sit in and I do it. I the first word is be, and that's what I work on, just be. I mean, I listen to the traffic outside and the gurgling in my stomach and the noise around and the stuff that's going on. I just be, and then I be still. I just stop moving. Just stop moving within that world. Just stop moving. Be still. Be still and know. And what I do is I try to open up my mind. I just try to open it up. I just try to know. Be still and know that I am. That center of me, that thing that they call the soul, or the spirit of love or whatever it is, that it is, that I am. Be still and know that I am God. That it's connected. That's connected to you, and it's connected to something beyond us. I love the Buddhist greeting, you know, which is the God in me salutes the God in you. I absolutely love that. You know, I believe that we're created in the image and likeness of God, but I don't think it's the way we look. I mean, look around here. I mean, we don't all look alike. I believe we look like God when we're active, loving. I think that's what God is the healing power of love, you know? And I see the family resemblance in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time. I see it with the little old lady who says to some 15-year-old chick who's got half her head shaved off and the other spiked in purple with, you know, stuff pierced all over her body, say, come sit next to me, darling. I see the similarity. I see the family resemblance. The guy who gets on the bus and goes a half an hour down to central office and gets the literature and takes the box and gets on the bus and comes back to the meeting. I see the family resemblance. The one who gets there an hour before the meeting and puts the coffee on, I see the family resemblance. I see it when one of those old guys is holding one of the new guys in his arms while the new guy cries his eyes out in the middle of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I see the family resemblance. I see it in the stuff that we do when we're loving each other. That's when we look like God. And then the 12th step comes along, and that's got three parts to it, and it's a really important deal. And some of us forget that it's got three parts, but it says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That's the promise in the second step, that will be restored to sanity. You know, when after the 12 steps were written, Carl Jung, who was a fairly bright guy, and knew a little bit about us, and said that, you know, an alcoholic was a hopeless case unless he had some kind of massive spiritual kind of revolution within himself. But there was no treatment for it. when Bill Wilson sent him a copy of the 12 steps, he wrote back and said it was a perfect treatment for alcoholism. And now I understand that there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous who need to take psychotropics in order to be sane enough to be sober. Not as many as the medical profession would like us to think. But there is a spiritual awakening in the first part of the 12th step, and that is being restored to sanity. I have been restored to sanity. I can't cop to being crazy. I'm not crazy. I would love to be someday. I mean, I would love to enter the victim industry. You know? But the fact is that I'm utterly responsible for everything I do. Absolutely. You know, nobody ever suggested that I drink a quart of scotch a day. No doctor ever wrote me a prescription and said, here, abuse this. Nobody ever suggested the stuff that I did. I did it. I'm absolutely responsible for my disease, and therefore I'm absolutely responsible for my recovery. So I'm not crazy. I'm self-centered. I'm self-destructive. I'm self-promoting. I'm self. That's what I am. And so I have been doing service since the beginning of this thing, trying desperately to be more concerned about you than I am about me. And some days I am. But I keep doing it because I keep getting weller. I mean, I'm not recovered. I'm not recovered. I can't afford that phrase. Because if I felt that I was recovered, I'd relax. And I'm not the kind of guy that can relax. Because once I relax, I get to thinking. And once I get to thinking, I start making decisions on my own. Once I make decisions on my own, I find myself out there. You know, a drink is the end of a slip. A drink is the end of a slip. And what a slip is a high arcing dive into the drink. And the bouncing on the diving board is the cutting down on the meetings. It's the not calling my sponsor. It's no use talking to you because you couldn't really understand. It's, those people are just ridiculous. I mean, I got more stuff to do here. I mean, there's careers to think about. What about relationships? Ah, you know? And let me tell you, I've slipped a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous. I never drank, but I slipped a lot of times. That's the structure I live my life in. This fellowship is designed to return us to normal life, to become productive members of society. If you're talking to some guy with 10 years of sobriety who's going to 18 meetings a week, he's hiding out. The idea is that we get out there. The most effective 12-step work we can do is if we're out in the world and they don't know we're drunk. You know, if we blend into society and work in society, if we're members of communities, if we're taxpayers, if we belong to PTAs, we stand on soccer fields and watch our kids play, if we're fathers and mothers and husbands and wives, if we're the kind of people that we thought were impossible to be, with this structure, we can be whoever we need to be. I love being at a dinner party and having some guy say, man, I really wish I could cut down on my drinking. And be able to say, yeah, I know how you feel, I've been there. And eventually tell him I'm an alcoholic. And if he says, you're an alcoholic? Then I've done my work, man. If he guesses before that, I'm in trouble. So I'm a husband. Wish I was a better one. I'm a pain in the ass to live with. She needs to keep going to those meetings. And I'm really glad she does. When we first arrived in this fellowship, if you looked at us as a couple, she was the one who was clearly in trouble. She never got her hair done, so she always wore babushka. She wore these kind of shapeless dresses. Her nails were bitten to the quick, and her lips were disappearing. That happens to Al-Anons. And there was nothing funny in her life. I was always kind of
just fine. Ananias performed a miracle on that woman. She's beautifully dressed today. She's beautifully coiffed. She gets manicures regularly. And she's known in Al-Anon for her laugh. That's the great gift of Al-Anon in our life, is Bonnie's laugh. Every time she laughs, I thank you guys. I really do. I've got a 16-year-old daughter. Now, you have beautiful and intelligent children, but I have Kate. She's 5'7", she's redheaded, and she is a fierce woman. She is fierce. She's tough and bright and funny, and I love hanging out with her. I just love it. She's getting ready to go to college to be God knows what. She's done her little experimenting. She got drunk once. She was 14, and she got drunk. And it was great. I mean, it was just great. She blacked out, threw up, and ruined her reputation in one night. So I said, okay, you got your talk. Now let's quit that. And she's a great kid. She's a great kid. I don't think she's one of us. Her best friend is 2 years sober, 16 years old, and Kate's moving in the Al-Anon direction. I mean, she's really, she makes Jackie's life a nightmare. You know, you're going to a meeting. I've had an interesting life, a real interesting life, more interesting than I really wanted it to be, but it's been an exciting adventure in the last several years. The last couple of years have been incredible. We moved from Southern California to Canada 11 years ago, and I got the opportunity to start a multi-million-dollar company and to produce a motion picture and do a lot of interesting stuff. And while I was enjoying the absolute height of the success in my life, I was also diagnosed with skin cancer. I'm one of those blonde, blue-eyed kids who used to get sunburned regularly, and now I'm paying the price. So what happens is every 6 months I go to my doctor, and anything weird they cut out of me. It's been really interesting. My body now looks like a railroad map of New Jersey, and I've had to give up my night job with Strippergram. It culminated recently, a couple of years ago, with them taking my nose off, cutting out some cancerous stuff and sticking it back on, it was not one of my favorite procedures. What absolutely amazes me is that I was lying there and they're doing this thing. My incredible ability to be a real jerk, just kind of, you know, they're taking my nose off and they're doing the thing, and I'm lying there thinking they're going to discover more. I mean, it's not just going to be the nose. They're probably going to take probably half my face off. You know, that's probably what they're going to do. You know, I've got to talk at some conventions. I suppose what I'll do is I'll probably wear like a mask, like the Phantom of the Opera. You know, and, you know, kind of, you know, talk after dinner with this mask over half of me. You know, people will say, "My God, look at that guy! I mean, what a spiritual giant! I mean, look." Yeah, they took away half his face, and he's still here. He flew all the way here to carry the message. He slurps a little when he talks, but God, what an example! I can't believe what an idiot I am. You know? Instead, they put my nose back on. It looked like I'd been in a bar fight for 2 weeks, and it's got this funny scar on it, and that's it. You know, but they keep doing that, and in the meantime, I got involved in a disastrous business thing, really disastrous, that cost me basically Kate's college education and any kind of retirement. I'm probably going to have to work until I'm 90 years old, and what it was a disastrous business thing, and I kept writing checks to fix it, and eventually when I went to Bonnie and said we need to put a third mortgage on the house, she said, "Hold it. Wait a minute. What is going on here?" Because I wasn't telling her. What I was going to do was write one more check and fix the problem and then tell her what the problem had been and how I had fixed it. Now, I don't know whether that's alcoholism or machoism or middle-age crazy or whatever it was, but it's not fair if you're in a relationship that's supposed to be 50-50. And Al-Anon had helped her get in touch with her feelings, and she just basically tore a strip off my ass and poured gasoline on it, just about to do it. I mean, that was one angry lady, and it wasn't about the money. What it was about was the trust, that I didn't trust her enough to tell her, and that I treated her like a little girl in that, and it wasn't fair. And we talked about it, and we talked and talked and talked, and it was the hardest time I think in our marriage, and I said I got to talk to Kate about this, and so after dinner one night I said, Kate, I need to talk to you about what's going on. And I said, you know, you're 15 and you're 14 years old, and you're starting to look at guys, and eventually one of those idiot mouth breathers is going to show up here at the door, and you're going to marry him, I just want you to know that if you're in a relationship that's 50-50, what I did is not acceptable, and this is what I did. And I told her, and I said, don't allow that to happen. And she said, I said, you know, I was trying to fix the problem without telling anybody, and I was going to come to you and tell you what I fixed. And she said, oh, Dad, I know exactly how you feel. I've been doing that in math. And she gave me a big hug. I mean, I love kids that are raised in the program because she's lived with these principles. And we had to sell the big house, and we started looking around at condominiums. This is not a horror story. I mean, you know, we were looking at nice condominiums. They were small, but they were nice, you know. And I finally found one that it looked like it would be okay, and I brought the girls over, and we walked into the condo, and it's smaller than what we've been living in. And Bonnie looked at it, and I could just see it kind of hit her. And Kate went looking around, and it's got two bedrooms and two baths and a, you know, great room and a kitchen. Kate came back, she was 15 years old, and she said, this is the space we live in now. We live in our bedrooms and the family room. We don't go into the living room or the dining room. What do we need all that stuff for? And I thought, thank God for 15-year-olds who have been raised in the program, you know. And so we lived there. So I was looking around for a job. Now, I'll be 57 years old in August, and they're not hiring guys like me. They're retiring guys like me. So I started looking for jobs, and I sent out 50 resumes and letters about and got 50 thank you and screw you letters back. And one day my sponsor, who's got 31 years of sobriety, and called me and said, listen, there's a job available, and you should put in a resume. I said, what is it? And he told me, I said, oh, man, not that job. And he said, have you done the third step today? And I said, yes. And he said, are you looking for a job today? And I said, yes. He said, then mail in your resume. So I did, and they interviewed, they got about 25 resumes. They interviewed six of us, and I got the job, which was to manage central office in Vancouver. And I've been there a little over a year, and it's real interesting. You know, some days I think of General Custer's last words. You know, I can't understand that they seem so friendly at the dance. You know. Yeah. I mean, some days that job is like being a kindergarten teacher in the Village of the Damned. Unbelievable. And on December 15th, they fired me. The operating committee fired me at 7:30, and then the intergroup committee as a whole rehired me at 10:15. The screaming and hollering went on until midnight. And that was that. We got through Christmas waiting for the other shoe to drop, and then in the January intergroup meeting, a group proposed that they readdress the motion and fire me again. So we went through that until midnight, and I have to open up the office every morning at 7 o'clock. So I left the meeting not knowing whether I had a job or not, and arrived at the office at 7 o'clock to open it up, and I said, you know, God, I said, God, you know, I'm starting to get pissed off, God. I mean, I think you're a really nice guy, and I know you're on my side, but I need a little attention right now, and I just don't understand what the hell's going on. You're going to have to make it real obvious to me. I cannot handle any more opportunities for growth. I just can't handle it anymore right now. You know, and I need my blessings undisguised. I mean, they got to be real obvious to me, or because I'm not getting something here, you know. And one of my phone volunteers called in and said she couldn't be there, and you know. So it's 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm trying to get somebody to cover a phone shift at central office, and I got this kid. He's 24 years old. He's got 4 years of sobriety, and he's a prize jerk. He's 24, 4 years sober, knows everything, you know, just everything. And he lectures me on the traditions. So he came in on that day. That's all I needed was Mark. So I'm doing something, and this kid walks in, this big, tall, drink of water kid. And I say, "Can I help you?" And he said, "I don't know." He said, "Look," he was nicely dressed, but his hands were all swollen and they were all covered in bloody scabs. And he said, "I was beating the walls last night." He said, "I don't drink all the time, but when I drink, something happens to me." And I said, "Yeah, I know." I said, "How old are you?" He said, "I'm 24. And he said that thing to me that I said the first day. He said, "What's wrong with me?" You know that question that comes from below your belly? "What's wrong with me?" And I said, "I don't know, but I'll bet Mark does." So I brought out the 24-year-old to meet the new 24-year-old, and they went into the boardroom and talked for 3 hours. I had to answer the goddamn phones, but I... So I said, "Okay, God, I get it. I get it. This is about keeping the doors open and the coffee on and the phone answered and the literature here. That's what it's about. It has nothing to do with me. It has absolutely nothing to do with me. What I got to do is suit up and show up." So that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing. It's the best job I've ever had for the worst people I've ever worked for. What I want, having worked at central office as a central office manager, what I want each and every one of you to do in this room is sometime this week go down to central office and apologize to the manager. Because you've probably all said the things that I've heard people saying about me. It's absolutely amazing. This fellowship eats its young. There's a swamp of resentment and viciousness and gossip in the center of this fellowship that has got to be eliminated. We've got to understand the first tradition, or we're going to kill ourselves. So I keep showing up at that thing and doing the thing, and things are getting repaired. The debt's going down a little, and Bonnie and I are still sleeping in the same bed, and Kate's growing up and getting to be a young woman, and my life goes on. And I wish I had something to wrap this up with, you see, but this is a journey. The next time I see you, I'll be someplace else along this journey. And I'll let you know how I'm doing on that, because, you see, that's what this thing is about for me. Is these are like oral examinations for me. You people are my teachers. You're the only ones who've ever been able to communicate to me, to teach me, to change me. I couldn't understand any of those other people out there. But when you said, "I know how you feel, and this is what I've done," then I've learned from you. So I stand before you tonight. I stand before you. You're a group of my teachers to let you know how I'm doing. And you can judge me. But if you do, be gentle. I know I got a long way to go. But because of you, I've come incredibly far. I'm comfortable with the idea of a higher power, with a God. I'm comfortable with my life. There are things I would change. I'm open to change. But man, you know, after all this nonsense with the intergroup and all this stuff that's been going on, and I've gotten vicious phone calls. I mean, people are just discussing me on, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I've got an assistant, and she's got 21 years of sobriety, and her brother died, and her older daughter is dying of cancer. And we were talking about life isn't fair. And we talked back and forth to each other, and I said, yeah, life isn't fair. You know, your brother shouldn't be dead, your daughter shouldn't be dying, I shouldn't be going through this stuff. I should be have a little money in the bank. You know, life isn't fair. But I shouldn't be sober either. I should be dead. I should be in jail. You bet life isn't fair. And thank God it isn't fair. If you're having trouble with this higher power thing, I'd just like to close with a thing. I took it off the wall of our area office. It's a closing prayer they use in the Soviet Union. And it came to be while the Soviet Union was a godless nation. And this is what the prayer is. I put my hand in yours, and together we can do what we could never do alone. Never again will we know hopelessness. Never again will we have to rely on our unsteady self-will. We are all together now, searching for power and strength that is greater than ours. And as we hold hands, we find love and understanding beyond our wildest dreams. Keep coming back. I love you.